This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You bitch! No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little lassies and fradashies at me, honey.
John Callier, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curb?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is broke right now.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, and if you can't tell from that, I don't know what to call it. It's a soundtrack. I was going to call it a great soundtrack, but I really, you know, it sends shivers down my spine in a really bad way, that soundtrack. It's, of course, the iconic music from Rocky.
That's right.
It's just like, it's too much machismo. I can't take it.
Well, all I can see in my mind's eyes is Rocky running up those stairs and, you know, punching the sky. You know, after his, you know, morning run.
When I went to Philadelphia, all anyone wanted to do was see those steps. And I was just like, it's cold, I want to go. It's like, we are dedicating the next hour to sporting fever in film because the entire state is football crazy.
That's right.
Which it always gets at this time of year, and we kind of have to sit there and bear it. So we thought, why not celebrate sports too?
You know what? And for me, I've had this really bizarre feeling of out-of-worldness because I live in Footscray, and driving around my suburb, there's all this colour out, all this red, white and blue. And my initial thought was is when I saw these flags out, I thought, oh, we have a lot of Thai people living here in Footscray. I thought they were Thai flags until the penny dropped that it was actually had to do with the Bulldogs in the grand final.
And someone had to point it out to you?
No. The penny did drop, although it did take there was a slight delay.
Well, fortunately, I'm in the studio this evening and I will beef up our sporting knowledge. I love that neither of us...
Is it Dumb and Dumber?
Yeah,
it's Dumb and Dumber tonight.
The blind leading the blind,
yeah, it is,
clearly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, we've taken a very outtake spin to sporting films this evening. So we are, of course, looking at queer sporting films. Uh-huh. And more than that, these are films that really challenge the masculinity that films like Rocky kind of reveled in.
Yes, that's... Yeah.
A good way of putting it.
It is a good way of putting it.
You know, there's no doubt that sporting fields have become something of an arena for the production of masculinity. I think that's fairly safe to say. It's been kind of overstated in the academy. And sporting films have been part of the movement kind of generating that kind of representation, I think.
That's right. And it's part of the how-to manual for young men to model themselves on how to be a man.
Well, exactly. Exactly. The sporting arena, we know for young boys, can be critical. And so it's great to see some queer sporting films, just a few of them, kind of challenging the authority of the sporting field, challenging this idea that it is on the sporting field that heteromasculinity, as opposed to masculinity in general, is kind of produced.
I think a couple of those films we'll explore that tonight. So we're talking about, funnily enough, most of our films have come from 2004.
I know.
Daniel, what is that? It was a big year
for
queer films
and
sport.
I love because it's really interesting that America has so few queer sporting films, and that all of the films that we've had to look at have come from outside of Hollywood. So two films from Germany tonight, Summer Storm and Guys and Balls.
Guys and Balls.
Which are both really great films. One's a comedy and one is this really sweet, earnest, really tender coming-of-age story.
It is. You know, that's a Summer Storm. I think you really identified with that one, didn't you, Daniel? I think we all did.
I think we all did.
And we're looking at a Thai film.
A 2003 Thai film. So, interestingly, really similar time.
It is.
And this is, of course, about it's a biography, I suppose, of a trans...
Kickboxer.
A trans woman who was also one of Thailand's greatest kickboxers.
That's right. But at the time, she was male, and she was transitioning. She was on her transition journey throughout this film, so we get to see that.
So I think it's a really interesting film when you kind of think about some of those ideas, you know, the authority of masculinity in the sporting arena, and how you can unpack that with a film like this. I think it goes a really long way to doing that,
and it challenges some of those preconceptions and ideas
in a very basic way, unfortunately. Because it's a pretty elementary film. I didn't love it.
No.
But it's done really well. And I think it's got something like 80% on Rotten Tomatoes.
And it scored well on IMDb. And it has won a swag of Best Picture films at a number of international film festivals.
You never can pick them.
No, you can't. You can't.
And the other, well, it's not a film. It's a series. But, you know, we couldn't not look at Barracuda, which is the most recent of all of the productions that we're looking at this evening. And I think Barracuda, of course, coming from the mind of Christos Chalkis. Oh,
you know, Christos.
Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. Loaded was just a revelation for me, that book.
AKA Head On.
Head On. It was later turned into a film, Head On, with Alex Dimitriatis.
And we have another very handsome Greek man. Oh, man of Greek extraction in Barracuda.
Well, lots of handsome men in Barracuda, to be fair.
A lot of abs.
A lot of abs, that's true. And a lot of skimpy bathing suits.
Yeah. Mm. Added to the viewing pleasure, I have to admit.
I love that you went there.
Listen, you take the high ground, I take the low ground. I thought we
That's
knew
the
that.
Dynamic.
That has been
really
well established, hasn't it?
Yeah. So, but I think, you know, we've chosen this. Obviously, there are a few other films, films like Bend It Like Beckham and Girl Fight, that do a really good job of challenging the masculine authority of the sporting arena too. Mm-hmm. But we've put together this set of four films because we think they stand really well together to kind of challenge not only the masculine authority of the sporting field, but the hetero-masculine authority of the sporting field.
And in life in general, really. It is.
Well,
I mean, the sport is a metaphor for life, is it not?
Well, it's become a metaphor for Australia, funnily enough. Like, in a really kind of upsetting way.
Mm-hmm. And Melbourne in particular, and we're living
especially
through it right
at this time of the year. Here, for instance, is a trailer for one of this country's sporting channels. I won't say which one because this isn't a plug, but I think it really kind of praises, you know, what sports means to this country. Yes, it's being a little bit ironic, but I think there's some seriousness in it too.
Mm-hmm. Hasn't heard of Fala, you know, the racehorse whose heart now resides in our National Museum. And who can forget taking the America's Cup from America? Bradman, Freeman, Rose. In any other country, these would just be sports stars. But in Australia, these are the heroes who've shaped our nation. For our history is not written in books. It's etched into trophies. We're a sporting nation.
That's hilarious.
It is hilarious, but unfortunately, it's the way people think.
And I can think of two other things that go hand in hand with that. And I don't say this lightly, but we've got Australia is a sporting nation, but it's the land of Anzac, and it's also the land of the man from Snowy River. And I think that actually comes out in Barracuda as well.
Really?
It does, yeah. Right. You know, where they're, you know, at the Sydney Olympics, and they're talking about how they brought the team together. Anyway, let's not go there. We can come back to that.
Okay, we'll come back to that. Let's take the pressure off.
Yeah.
We want to hear from you. If you're listening, if you have a favourite sporting film, we want to know what your favourite sporting film is. And you know what? We will give you bonus points if you can give us a favourite queer sporting film, because we are, after all, a queer cinema program, and we're putting a queer lens on sporting films tonight. So we want to know what your favourite queer sporting film is, or just tell us your favourite sporting film.
That's right. And we're going to keep you in suspense tonight because we're going to tell you what our favourite sporting films are at the end of the show. So you'll have to stay tuned for that.
So we've got a jam-packed programme coming up this evening. Some really excellent films to unpack. And coming up right after this is our interview with Glenn Donar, an academic at RMIT who studies masculinities and is going to speak to us about the sporting field as a metonym for masculinity. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
And you're on Outtakes here on Joy, and tonight we're talking about sport and queer film, and in particular, masculinity.
Queer sporting films and how they, I suppose, challenge the authority of the sporting arena as a metonym for masculinity, and the production of masculinity.
You know, that's a meaty subject, Daniel, and we're definitely going to sink our teeth into that tonight.
In an authority. So we've got on the line Glenn Donar, who is an academic in masculinities at RMIT, widely published on the topic. Thank you so much for joining us this evening, Glenn.
No worries at all, Daniel.
So, Glenn, we are, of course, looking at sporting films this evening and the way they, I suppose, reiterate and reify certain masculine ideals. When we talk about masculinity in films, but also in broader culture, what exactly are we looking at?
Well, I guess what's kind of interesting, and particularly when we look at kind of popular cultural representations of masculinity, and particularly kind of hyper-masculine representations in pop culture and film, is that it kind of shows us that rather than masculinity being something that's natural or fixed, it's actually, you know, highly contingent, so it depends very much on the context in which it's being produced and expressed. But masculinity is constructed, it's fluid, dynamic, and plural. So as well as there being kind of dominant ideas of masculinity, there are, I guess, non-dominant or non-normative masculinities that are and masculine expressions that are also kind of evident, and they're particularly evident in sports films.
Glenn, would you say that this dominant masculinity, what I think is referred to as hegemonic masculinity, mm-hmm. Variously in the literature, would you say that it derives its strength and authority from the subordination of those other masculinities?
It does. I mean, it defines itself through other masculinities. I mean, we also think of gender and masculinity in this case as relational. So it needs to be performed in the world, and it needs to be kind of understood and recognized by others for it to gain its kind of definition. And part of doing that is also kind of much less positively associated with the subordination of less normative, less kind of powerful masculinities.
So are these films trying to portray the most desirable form of masculinity by ridiculing or, as you say, undermining these other marginal forms of masculinity?
I don't think that happens. I think a lot of these sports films actually are kind of interesting. I think sports and film itself is kind of an interesting space where both as particular kind of fields where norms and conventions and power can actually be challenged and at least temporarily be overwhelmed, and we can kind of take pleasure in that. I also think that if we keep talking about sports films, that even though the sports arena is a charged homosocial space and that does typically celebrate and reinforce hegemony and normativity, and we're talking of race, of gender, of sexuality, in some ways, and I think this is quite ambivalent, but in some ways in film, just as in life, it can actually be kind of a safe or other space where alternatives can be expressed and where hegemony can be challenged, and those alternatives can be celebrated, those kind of challenges to hegemony. And I think of this as positive, but also, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword as well, because at the same time, it's a safe space to express and to challenge, to express alternatives and challenge hegemony, but it's also a safe space in which that can be, that challenge can be kind of contained and managed, and so kept to that safe space rather than seeping out into the real world or beyond the film.
That's a really interesting idea. When we are looking at kind of these films that do challenge masculinity within this confined space, as you say, and a lot of the films that we're looking at tonight actually do that really well. But when we talk about challenges to masculinity, what exactly are we talking about challenging? What are some of the tropes, especially in film, in Hollywood cinema, that have emerged as characteristic of, if I can say, real men, you know, so to speak? Pun, you know, irony.
With scare quotes, always with scare quotes.
Yeah,
definitely.
Look, I think that's what's kind of quite interesting, because I think that we're kind of very, I think many of us are really attentive to that idea of you can't present a real man without scare quotes anymore. Yeah. And I think some of the kind of dominant, idealized ideas of masculinity in film and kind of what we would call male action genres, in some ways they kind of, they're a bit problematic for ideas of kind of, or yeah, ideals of masculinity as kind of, as there being kind of this natural kind of real man that we should aspire to outside of time, because a quote unquote real man is kind of reveals how constructed masculinity is. And look, even in films like Rocky, where Rocky's kind of interesting and perhaps a little bit more complex than we can kind of, I guess, remember.
Or want to give it credit for being. It's not, yeah, it's, I mean, not a very attractive, you know, thought to give Rocky any credit for me, at least.
Look, I do adore the film, I have to admit. But
there you go.
But it also... But, you know, it's a kind of, that's an underdog masculinity that is there to challenge kind of more perfect, complete forms of masculinity. I mean, there's a lot going on racially in Rocky that we'll kind of leave aside for the moment. But I think it's kind of interesting, because I was thinking a lot about some of the queer sports films you mentioned, and also kind of, I guess, non-queer sports films. And it's kind of interesting how often that there's a celebration of the underdog, and the underdog is actually kind of a, if we're talking about masculinity, kind of an incomplete or a failed version of masculinity, and is often trying to challenge what is seen as too perfect and unrealistic.
But Glenn, if I can come to the underdog narrative for a moment, my reading of the underdog narrative, and of course, please feel free to challenge me on it, is that you know, they start out as some kind of other version of masculinity, and the underdog narrative takes them to that celebrated form of masculinity, and when we leave the film, at the end of the film, they are that hegemonic masculine ideal.
I agree. I see that as aspirational. I see that where the audience is aspirational, trying to get to that idealized form of...
And often they do. Yes. Glenn, what do you think of that?
Look, I think that you're... I'm willing to go kind of 85-90% of the way with you. I'm always looking for... I'm actually always kind of looking for gaps and slippage.
Yeah.
And I don't think that... even though there's this kind of desire to solve anxieties about manhood, there's this desire to remasculinize, to redefine hegemony and power, I think it's kind of always interesting, because there's always a gap. First of all, it's always somewhat incomplete, and it's also still shows that masculinity is constructed, performed, and plural. So, I agree that there's this attempt to kind of renorm and to kind of replace kind of dominant ideas of masculinity and manhood, and just kind of redefine them slightly. But it is always interesting that at least it shows us that there are other masculinities and that available to us.
You talk about masculinity being constructed and a performance and plural. Can masculinity ever be non-performed? Can it be authentic and natural?
Only in scare quotes.
Yeah. It's squared. Okay, so I guess...
And I think for me that's kind of what I always... That's kind of the hope that I always kind of hold on to. It doesn't mean that the pressure of hegemony and dominance and kind of the dominant ideas are not kind of totally overwhelming for us, you know, particularly as we're growing up or kind of dealing with kind of figuring out who we are, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
But these films and kind of demonstrate that there is always an alternative,
mm-hmm.
And that there's always that it is always performed and it is always constructed.
That is, in a way, I kind of feel a little bit saddened by that and a little bit depressed that men who typify masculine men can never really relax and be themselves and be their true selves, and that they're.
But we know,
It's an act.
But we know that this masculine ideal is just that. It's an ideal. It's never fully realized. Mm-hmm. That the purpose of dominant hegemonic masculinity is to be this thing that you strive for, and no one ever attains it because, you know, I think Connell draws out this beautiful example of a sportsman, and you think of the ideal sportsman who's, you know, up going to parties after, you know, playing on the field and drinking, and the reality is that would never happen because the athlete, you know, goes to bed early so they can get up early to train. And so this mm-hmm. idea that we get through cinema of, you know, what, you know, quote unquote real men are like, yep. it's just not real.
So it's chasing the impossible dream, and it's just, it is a pedestal. We're putting these men on a pedestal. Glenn, I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on that? About it being an impossible dream and that that this is an unachievable goal for most of us, yeah. Thanks for that, Daniel. Yeah,
it is so. For all of us, and I think that's, for me, yes, that is... kind of disheartening and saddening, but it also means that in some ways it can be liberatory, because if none of us can achieve that ideal, then, as in none of us, even these paragons of kind of masculinity, and look, we can kind of mention, well, I should mention a footballer like Lance Franklin, who everybody thought had had it all, but had so many
problems. I have no idea who Lance Franklin is.
Oh, sorry.
Buddy Franklin, who plays for the Swans. Franklin, so even yeah, I know right. that.
Oh, no. God. That's why it's dangerous.
But anyway, look, last year, you know, he basically had to pull out of the AFL finals because of kind of struggles with mental health, and it kind of shows that the pressure it does put all in this case, if we talk about gender and masculinity and associate it with males, which we don't need to, it shows that it overwhelms all of us because of that pressure, and for me it's about kind of talking about how maybe we should all once we understand that's what's happening, that it can kind of free us from the need to, or at least for us to be aware of what we're doing.
And so would that mean that we need to lead ourselves to subvert the idea and develop our own idea of masculinity, be true to ourselves, live our own truth? And I'm doing the air quotes as we speak.
Yeah, we have to. Well, I've succeeded if you do air quotes all the time. But but for me, it's that, you know, that each and every one of us has kind of multiple gender identities that we need to kind of express in different contexts. You know, we act differently if we go to a sports contest, or we're at a different type of film, or you know, home versus the workplace. Our kind of gender expression changes depending on the context. So I kind of think of that multiplicity and plurality as kind of part of my identity, let alone across the whole spectrum of kind of men and women in a particular society.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's been enlightening and
fascinating for me. And
yeah. I think Alan's had an awakening.
Oh, yeah, definitely. This whole idea of the plurality at the end actually really does strike a chord with me.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thanks, Glenn.
No worries. It was a pleasure.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are looking at queer sporting films and the way those films challenge the masculine authority of the sporting arena.
Oh, what a meaty subject it is. And we've had some people message in with their favourite sporting film.
We have. So Whoopi from Caulfield has messaged in to say, there must be queer sport films that show more than the gay boys hiding in the drama centre during gym class. Do theatre sports count? Whoopi says Bend It Like Beckham is still her favourite.
And we also have another message here from Steve at Thornbury. He says, hi guys, another sport-based film is Iron Ladies, which is about a gay trans volleyball team in Thailand.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, where we are looking at queer sporting films, and this must be the queerest take, the campest take after that song, on sporting films that's ever been attempted, I think. That is, of course, the final track from the soundtrack to Summer Storm, a 2004 German, would we call it dramedy? It's a tender coming-of-age story. It's a really sweet film. It is, as someone put to me years ago, it is a very earnest film. It wears its heart on its sleeve.
Oh, it does. And it's the main character, Toby, who is wearing his heart on his sleeve. And you can see how confused and distraught he really is as to this internal conflict that he's having with the feelings for his best friend and this love triangle that he's in.
And, you know, in many ways, it's a classic coming of age story with a queer kind of take, and it's something that we've looked at in a lot of depth on Outtakes before in previous programs, but here the really fresh thing about it is setting that struggle to the sporting field and showing how, you know, each, you know, you've got the struggle of kind of reckoning with your sexual identity, but on top of that, mm-hmm. you have to do that against this very masculine backdrop that is the sporting field.
That's right.
And it is very masculine in Summer Storm. You know, it's not a soccer field, it's not a football field, this is about a rowing competition.
It's a regatta.
Yes.
It's a new word for you, Daniel. I know how much you like new words.
I do like new words. I don't really deal with sports-related words very often.
So it's a rowing team, and it's coming together in a rowing competition at this regatta. So there's a lot of other teams competing at the same time.
Yeah, so the tension in the film takes place when this team that Toby is a part of, you know, they're really looking forward to this all-female team taking part in the competition, and that's replaced by a team called Queerschlag.
That's
German
right.
for Queer Strokes. But it sounds so much more, I don't know, strange.
Evocative in English, doesn't it?
No, in German.
Oh.
Queerschlag.
Queerschlag. Okay.
But it's replaced by this queer team. And of course, they have this kind of drive to beat the queer team because they can't be seen to lose against a team of...
That's right. I think we should also mention, too, that the masculine team the straight team, it comes from a part of Germany that is quite conservative,
yes.
And where the men are men,
yes.
And so it's part of Bavarian, and I think there's that stereotype that they are quite
but there's
masculine.
There's a really interesting dynamic in this film, I think, because of course Toby is part of that team,
mm-hmm.
and so here he has this conflicting drive on the one hand to beat the Queer Strokes because he's very invested as a sportsman.
That's
but
right.
on the other, to look at them with a kind of longing to want to be them and to be accepted by them and to have a sense of community, which they show.
So that's right.
So, you know, it really is the case that setting this coming-of-age story against the sporting arena really does heighten the stakes in many ways because, he's clearly not just playing for his sexual identity, he's playing for his gender identity as well.
And that's right, and I think this is also juxtaposed by the fact that there are female rowing teams as well, and from this, from their hometown, there actually is a male team and a female team. And throughout the film, you see that the female team very much plays second fiddle. And I think this really plays into the idea that male sports and male, the male sporting persona is more important than the female sporting persona. And I think that's also comes to play in this film as well.
I think a little bit unfortunately, and perhaps not surprisingly, the females are secondary characters in this film, and they're really only there to kind of propel the narrative and to propel or really to mediate the attraction between the men in this film. And we've seen that before.
That's right.
You know, this classical idea of homosociality and the female being the conduit of desire, and that's clearly what the women are in this film. So, I mean, that's a bit of a shame. Not surprising in this kind of film.
No, it's not. And I think we see that quite well, Daniel, with Toby, who's the main character, the guy struggling with his sexuality, and how he carries a torch for his best friend. He's in love with his best friend. What a surprise! I think we've all been there, and his best friend really gives Toby a load of free passes when he's displaying what we would normally associate as unmasculine behaviour, because he has a love interest in Anka, his supposed girlfriend. And I think that, you know, slowly his boyfriend, if I can use that word, Daniel, slowly starts to realise that not as all as it seems with Toby.
And I think this film sits really nicely along the ironically 2004 produced film Guys and Balls. Mm-hmm. You know, same country, it's from Germany as well. And it does tackle again the heteromasculine authority of the sporting arena. And Guys and Balls does it in a really similar way, although this is a comedy, and it's been billed as Germany's first major sporting comedy. So I think it's really interesting to see it as Germany's first major sporting queer comedy. If I can get all those words out, but also just, you know, Germany's first major sporting comedy. I think that's really nice. But
I didn't know that, Daniel. But you know, that's interesting to see. But I think in Guys and Balls, I think the way they explore this is through the use of gay stereotypes, unashamedly so.
No,
and then blowing them up.
Yeah, absolutely. So this film is about a gay goalkeeper, Eki, who's playing on a boys team, and they find out that he is gay and kick him off the team. And so Eki decides to put them in their place by assembling this all gay team.
Yep.
And, you know, all shades of the rainbow are in this team, you know, not all shades of the rainbow, but all kinds of gay are in this team. Mm-hmm. And it is a real celebration of queer culture, I think, this film. And to see that queer celebration on the sporting field, you know, this is a soccer film. I think that's exactly what Glenn was talking about, where, you know, you can have these celebrations on the sporting field. The dangerous thing is when they become confined to the sporting field.
Yeah. And I think one thing about this film, which I think really does strike a chord with me, Daniel, is that very concept of where Eki is really banished from the team because he is gay.
Mm.
And that really made me think about my own sporting experiences when I was young.
Your illustrious sporting
my
career.
My illustrious sporting career, because I think like many gay people, we were, the other kids sort of sensed that we were different. We were other. We were queer. And often we were always the last ones picked for a sporting team. And I think this is a common experience for most of us.
Well, fortunately for me, I carried, the masculine, these masculine traits really well. So
you do, Daniel, and you know, and it would surprise me that you experienced that sense of otherness as being the last child picked for a sporting team.
God, the worst was swimming classes in those tiny little speedos. Did not look like the boys in Barracuda, let me tell you. I was a sight to be seen. God.
I don't think there were very many boys at school who looked like the boys at Barracuda. But it was interesting, you know, from my own experience from this point of view, I really didn't pursue team sports. I actually pursued solitary sporting
That's
activities,
a bit sad.
Which was swimming and squash, where you had full control over what you did, and you really didn't have to rely on the team to give you acceptance and or to empower you. You could empower yourself.
Well, that's the thing about Barracuda. I think it mediates, you know, the loneliness of swimming with the kind of team culture that swimming can engender as well, and pits the main character, you know, in that struggle, in the in-between space, at once a loner and at once so wanting to be part of something bigger. We might talk more about Barracuda right after this.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, where we are celebrating some of the queerest sporting films and how they challenge the authority, the masculine authority of the sporting arena.
And we were just talking briefly before about how we, you know, some sports can be quite solitary, and that sort of really leads us into the swimming aspect of Barracuda. So when you're in the water, it is a very solitary experience where you're within your mind and within the water, but there's also that interaction that you have with your teammates. And I think this is what Barracuda sort of really explores initially, is how Danny, who is a young kid from Reservoir, who sort of moves into a very posh private school on scholarship, and yes, how he really tries to crack. He goes in on scholarship as a swimming scholar.
Well, this is, of course, crack the swim based team on Christos Chalkis's novel by the same name, Barracuda. Mm. And we know that Chalkis does a really good job of interrogating class. Not just class, but race. And yes, sexuality and gender. He does such a wonderful job of really unpacking so many of these ideas.
And do you know what? I think Barracuda really does race, class, and gender well. But I really didn't pick up on the sexuality very much.
It was underplayed. It was very subtle. It was a bit of a shame. It was underplayed, and I'm not sure what the rationale behind that was.
Yes.
But you know,
I actually feel cheated. I actually feel disappointed that the Barracuda, the miniseries, actually didn't explore Danny's sexuality in greater depth.
Well,
I mean,
for me,
it was a surprise.
This is the thing. You know, I'm a firm believer that one should not judge a film by the book it's based on.
Yeah.
And that the two should, you know, a book and a film should sit alongside each other, mm-hmm, not on top of each other in comparison, and can lend themselves to each other. However, that said, I find, and I've found for some time, that Chalkis's work is so much better in the printed word, because it is so edgy and it is so risque and it is so gritty and raw and authentic. And somehow when these works are translated for the screen, they lose something. At least that's my experience.
You know what, Daniel, I agree with you from and I've read a lot of Chalkis's work.
Yeah.
And I would agree with you 100%. However, the reverse is true for Barracuda. And I have spoken to many people who have read Barracuda, and a lot of people who haven't actually finished reading Barracuda. And yet they've watched the miniseries, they've watched the ABC production, and they've loved it. And I think that's because I think for some reason in Barracuda, Christos is a little bit self-indulgent, and he really doesn't get to the point. You know, usually his books are fast-paced, they move very quickly, and they hook you. Unfortunately, yeah, Barracuda really doesn't do that in printed form, but the miniseries actually does a very good job.
Well, for people listening at home, this is Barracuda.
I'm stronger. I'm faster. I'm better.
Based on the novel by Christos Chalkis.
I'm going to be the best.
That's what it's all about, isn't it? Competition.
And from the producers of The Slap.
He's going to be one of the greats. He's going to be a champion.
Comes the major four-part drama.
I just want you to remember where you came from, who you are.
Barracuda starts Sunday, July 10 on ABC and iView.
Yeah, so surprise, you missed it. It's already aired. But no, it is available for purchase online. And it's a strong miniseries. I think it is a really strong, even though it does, as we've noted, underplay some of those themes that are around sexuality, mm-hmm, that Chalkis does so well. It is still a really strong, and it is in many ways a gritty series, and it does do a good job of interrogating class and race.
Oh, it does, and especially class and race here in Melbourne. Mm. So I think for Melbourneites, it's going to resonate quite strongly.
And there is something about the sporting arena. You know, we are looking at sporting films this evening, and there is something about the sporting arena that lends itself to this interrogation of class, to this interrogation of race and nationality, mm-hmm, because, you know, not a lot of people don't like to say it, but the sporting field, you know, it's not just about the production of masculinity, but it's about the production of white hegemonic masculinity. And that's how it's been in this country.
Oh, Absolutely. I mean, look what's happened in this past season with the racial slurs that have occurred against Adam Goods in this last season of AFL, and in particular the other Indigenous players who have really suffered from the spectators and also too from the commentators.
It's something about, I think it's got to do with the competitiveness of the sporting arena. Mm-hmm. Somehow when you get into the pool or you get on the football field or you get on the soccer field, whatever it is, mm-hmm. you kind of leave political correctness because you're in that competitive zone.
And it's a battlefield. Sport is a metaphor for battle in many ways. And, you know, and part of that is establishing who the enemy is. And sometimes it's establishing, as we've said before, the other. And, well, you know, and that's your target.
That's the amazing thing. Masculinity is a battlefield. It mm-hmm. is about establishing the other. And it is about giving yourself masculine authority by taking somebody else's masculine authority away.
It's about dominance and power.
Yeah, absolutely, and battle, as you say.
And I think that's what we saw in Barracuda, Quiet. That was exemplified. It was in the very first episode.
Absolutely. You had Danny coming. And interestingly, this was the only episode written by Christos Chalkas. He wrote the first screen teleplay.
Okay.
But you have Danny coming into this predominantly white school of very upper-class people, and he's a threat.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it's not just about being beaten, but it's about being beaten by someone who performs masculinity, race, nationality, whatever it is, to a lower standard, you know, inverted commas.
In their mind.
Yeah, then you do.
In their mind. And only to have their asses whipped by him. So, you know.
Well, we're not giving away the ending because...
There's a bit of humble pie to be eaten.
And it's a little bit melancholy, I think, the ending. It's bittersweet.
You know what? I'm so glad you mentioned that because, you know, that theme, that melody of melancholy really travelled throughout the whole four episodes for me. I was left at the end. It was a layering of melancholy on melancholy. Like it was, I actually found it quite sad, but yet strangely fulfilling.
In many
Satisfying.
Ways, it charted the same character arc and story arc as Teenage Kicks, a film that we looked at a couple of months ago, which is again about race and nationality and ethnicity and masculinity, and it's a coming of age story, and
it
charted that same kind of gritty territory, which. In a coming-of-age narrative, which this is, it feels really authentic, you know, because that's what youth is like. That's what coming-of-age is like. Mm. It's not clean. It's messy. And these films that translate that messiness through their sensibility and aesthetic, you know, I think that's why they're so strong.
And I think in Barracuda, the messiness was actually quite repressed because Danny was repressed. You could see it seething.
It was
anger.
Frustration.
And, repression. It was just seething away and boiling away underneath and then boom.
We are talking queer sporting films here on Outtakes.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, where we have been looking at queer sporting films and how they challenge masculinity.
It has been challenging. I felt my masculinity challenged, just as yours, Daniel, just as you're a paragon of masculine virtue, so was mine. And you know what? What's really exciting is that we have
a new membership come through.
It's the first for me being on air.
So thank you to Chris for joining the Joy family.
Yes, thanks, Chris. Thank you very much.
Now, just a few minutes left before the end of the program. So we're going to blitz through our top sporting films. Queer films aside, so we've looked at some excellent queer sporting films this evening. And, you know, I do love Summer Storm and Guys and Balls and Barracuda. I think it's great. Alan, what are your top sporting films?
My all-time favourite involves a character called Mr. Miyagi, Karate Kid. Is my favourite sporting film of all time.
Okay.
My next favourite one, and does cheerleading count? Is that a sport?
I think it is.
Yeah.
I'll bring it on.
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely. One of my favourites. Yeah. I've seen it many times, and I'm happy to watch it any time it comes on the TV.
That's your kind of sporting film.
That is my kind of sporting film. Love it. My third one is Bend It Like Beckham.
Yes, of course.
That's just an absolute favourite, isn't it?
Yeah.
So far, I haven't actually had a male, apart from Karate Kid. Two more. My second last one is A League of Their Own with Rosie O'Donnell
and
Madonna. I mean, what's not to
we'll
like about that?
We'll talk about a queer sporting film.
And Gina Davis.
I know.
Some icons there.
Yeah.
And my last one would have to be Show Me the Money.
No. Yes. I can't stand that film.
Oh, come on.
No.
Renee Zellweger. She was great in this film. And the little cute blonde kid. Oh, he was adorable.
Okay, yeah. My top five.
Yes, go for it.
I'm going to go Seabiscuit as number one. Oh. Tobey Maguire, horse racing, which I think is a really interesting kind of sports film.
The Sport of Kings.
Number two, Whip It. Drew Barrymore directed, starring Ellen Page, who is one of our queer favourites.
That's right.
Number three.
I can just think of Cream there and when I hear Whip It. Whip It Good. What's that song? Whip it good. Anyway, sorry.
My number three is Warrior. So Warrior was Tom Hardy and Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton, who did a really fantastic job in this film. And finally, I'm going to go with Cinderella Man, which was a Ron Howard film with Renee Zellweger again, of all people, and Russell Crowe in a boxing film, and a really great one.
Cinderella Man?
Yeah, Ron Howard film.
Oh, okay. And we also have another message that's just come in from...
Brad. Oh, it's from Brad.
Brad. It says, I don't know the show you're talking about, but I disagree that masculinity, or better still, the lack thereof, equals power, or the lack of it. The LGBTI community challenges stereotypes constantly, and drag can be a way of empowering people.
Could not agree more, Brad. That's actually a really good note to finish on. These films, they do challenge the power associated with masculinity.
Without a doubt.
So that's it for another week on Outtakes.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.